Today, we start with a riddle. What am I? I am the distinguishing mark of savagery. Savage, uncivilized peoples. I am the unspeakable practice at the heart of the true story that inspired the great American novel, Moby Dick. I am the last resort of castaways in ancient times, and even the most extreme of our modern-day survival stories, including famously a plane-crashed rugby team lost in the Andes. And I am the ultimate curse scenario that God threatened to bring into the land of Israel if she turned aside from him to abominations and idolatries. A threat made in no less than 5 different Old Testament books. So what am I? The answer is cannibalism. I know, yet another cannibalism sermon. So horrific a thing, I hesitate to mention it from the pulpit, yet the story of Joseph requires me to. Now that might seem like an odd claim. Give me a few minutes and you'll see what I mean. But first we have some historical background to catch us up to speed with the Joseph story here that we've heard in chapter 42. In the mid-1800s, archaeologists digging in Egypt unearthed the largest written document that we have today from ancient Egypt. They cracked open a tomb in Luxor, Egypt, and found what's become known as the Great Harris Papyrus. It was a scroll 140 feet long, and it contained all sorts of information that Egyptologists, you know, a treasure trove for Egyptologists that they love to study ever since. One section of that scroll contained records of vineyards, and it was discovered that there were 433 vineyards that produced exclusively for the temples, the religious temples, in a single city, in Thebes. 433 vineyards, all owned exclusively by the temples. That's a lot of wine. Not surprisingly, archaeologists have also found in the remains of the priests from ancient Egypt evidence of liver damage caused by chronic overdrinking. It was also discovered in ancient Egypt that the ancient Egyptians were so well fed in general as a people that they actually had developed, in their medicine men had developed a medical test to diagnose what we call today type 2 diabetes. Now that's a remarkable thing in the ancient world because you just don't typically find people with these sorts of diseases in the ancient world. It's not until modern times where food, you know, particularly junk food, becomes so plentiful that the average person can develop these sorts of conditions. But it was possible in biblical Egypt because biblical Egypt was the breadbasket of the ancient Near East. And that was possible because of the Nile River. The Nile River, we all learned about it in grade school, I'm sure. It's the longest known river in the world, and it flows from south to north. In and of itself, I have learned through study, that's not unusual. Lots of rivers do. If the ground in the south is higher than the ground in the north, then the river, if it starts in the south, is going to flow north. One example, sort of close to home, is the St. John's River in central Florida, apparently flows from south to north. What makes the Nile unique, though, is that because it's so long and it covers such a vast terrain, that where it starts down there in the south, in the central region of Africa, it collects all the rain from the central band of Africa. If you've ever seen a satellite image of the continent of Africa, you know that it's basically two colors. The top and the bottom are yellow because they're deserts. The largest desert in the world, right, is the Sahara. It's just vast spread across the top of Africa. It's all yellow and brown. And then the middle band, though, in the center, it's this rich, lush green color. It's dense jungle and rainforest there. And that is where the Nile River begins, in central Africa. So all the rain from the rainforest, particularly the seasonal rains, so there is a monsoon season there, which is about to hit, actually, right now. It's going to be, listen up, we're going to pray for the persecuted church in Sudan, because the monsoon seasons are about to begin there, and it's a real hardship for the people that live there now. But when they hit, especially in ancient times before the building of dams that stopped this, they swelled, caused giant mudslides there in the central region of Africa. And all of that mud would and rain would collect into what we call the Nile River. And believe it or not, that mud and that rich soil particulate would eventually make its way all the way, I'll say down, but it's really north, all the way up through the desert in Egypt to that Nile Delta. So in a country that's pretty much all desert, you had a single river that flowed through it. And because it started way up high in these rainforests, every year during monsoon season, it would begin to rise and then flood. And you basically have this little triangle, this delta of transplanted soil from a rainforest flowing down and dropped off in the middle of what would otherwise be a desert. So every year, I mean, it would be kind of like this. If the people in Ontario, Canada, had no water except from a river that started here in Florida, and they depended every year on hurricane season or something, the rains that hit us, and those rains created a water supply that flowed through a giant river and eventually made it up to and made it possible to live in Ontario, Canada. That's kind of the situation that I'm describing. So every year, seasonally, what would have otherwise been a poor desert region with a couple villages became a flood zone, and this the richest soil and farmland in anywhere in the region was transplanted down through from the jungles and the mountains up in Central Africa down into Egypt, and crops grew in abundance. That's the situation. Unless a year passes and there's no monsoon, there's no rain during the monsoon season. It was rare for that to happen, but it did occur, and there are records of it. And in years like that, there would be no farming possible down in the Nile Delta, in Egypt. It would basically mean no food could be grown that season to supply for that year. Now, that's a pretty devastating thing to think through. Imagine that there was no food production possible in our region for a year. That would be pretty hard to deal with. In the ancient world, it would have wiped out everybody's personal stores, whatever, you know, family or sort of community grain stores and food stores that they had. It would have been a pretty serious situation. Well, imagine that sometimes it happened twice. It was very rare, but sometimes you'd have 2 years consecutively where the monsoons just didn't come for some reason in Central Africa, and the Nile wouldn't swell, and you wouldn't get the banks wouldn't overflow with rich soil, and you wouldn't be able to farm for 2 years. Imagine the extremely rare scenario where that happened 3 years in a row. You would be desperate after 3 years with no food production. Well, remember Joseph's dream. Joseph's dream, and therefore the prediction, was this scenario, nightmare scenario, would be unfolding, not just 1 year, 2 years, three consecutive years. It would be 7 years. None of those rains would come in Central Africa. The Nile would be drying up. There would be no food, no production, no farming possible for 7 years. That truly is a nightmare scenario, a desperate scenario, which brings us full circle to that weird riddle where we started. What haunted Pharaoh so much about his dreams was that they were both symbolically about cannibalism. Those sickly, starving, skeletal cows were so desperate for food, they did something that cows just don't do. They turned on and devoured other cows. That's not done, right? And those shriveled, dying grains, they were eating other grains. Like eating like kind. It's a thing just not done, except in the worst, most desperate circumstances. There are a few stories, we tend not to read them, nestled in the pages of the Old Testament, that describe things getting so desperate. Again, they're usually linked to covenant curses and sins and rebellions and failures in Israel, where the people in Israel, in sheer desperation, resorted to cannibalism. And there were also a few of these stories in the history of ancient Egypt. And there is a chance, probably, Pharaoh, in his education and training, would have been told the stories from the past. So he may just have had the slightest inkling, as he pondered those dreams, that they were a warning about such a thing, such desperate circumstances coming upon the world. And if he suspected that, Joseph confirmed it. Here's the point. Too often we read the story of Joseph, we hear about the dreams and Joseph's interpretation, and we still sort of imagine a cartoon version of all these events. This scenario is horrendous beyond imagining. This is a very serious thing being described in the story of Joseph. It's what we would call apocalyptic. It would be as if the President of the United States started having nightmares about sitting in the Oval Office and looking out the window and seeing 7 mushroom clouds on the horizon. That's what these dreams are to Pharaoh. That's why he and all of his wise men are so alarmed by them. Joseph was saying, the days are coming when the Nile is going to fail, and the east wind is going to broil and scorch our land, and the people are going to starve and scavenge, and finally there is going to be such little food available to eat that the people are going to have no choice but to resort to the thing that is simply not done, either eat each other or die. That's a nightmare. And that is the world as it existed in the opening verses of Genesis 42. The whole land is in the grip of this horrible famine. No rain, no food, no crops growing anywhere. But because Pharaoh was warned in a dream beforehand, we know that the horrors of this famine are just beginning. Yet very few people know this, but we have this information, and Pharaoh and Joseph and a handful of his advisors have this information. And so they've made the preparations necessary to survive, and not just to survive themselves, but to provide for the rest of the world so that the world doesn't die. Now, I have to confess, I personally don't really know what it's like to experience true hunger. I mean, I'm sure I've gone without food for very short periods of time. Maybe you've experienced true hunger in your life. It tends, thanks be to God, it tends not to be something that Americans are acquainted with. But we do get hungry. We do have times where we want to be eating and can't eat for whatever reason. And you know, the very first human reaction to that situation is irritability, right? We call it getting hangry. And it's just miserable to be hungry. Your temper flares at the drop of a hat. And this is where we find Jacob and his sons. They're all suffering. They're all unable to do anything about this famine, hungry, but none of the sons seems to know what to do about it. So Jacob snaps at them in verse 2. Quit sitting around and just staring at each other. I heard that there's food in Egypt. The Egyptians have some grain stored up. Go travel down there and buy us some food, or we are all going to die. Historians suspect that the program was running in Egypt kind of like, you know, BOGOs at Publix. There was a per-person limit. And so the more people that you could send in line, the more you could stock up. So Jacob sends all of his sons down to get food, except he doesn't send his youngest son. His youngest and now favorite son, the new favorite, Benjamin. Because verse 4, he suspected if he sent his son, something bad would befall. And he'd lose his youngest son, Benjamin. So he keeps his youngest son, Benjamin, despite the fact that he could probably get even more food. He doesn't allow him to go. The story of Joseph, which is technically the story of Jacob, it fits within Jacob's overall story. It began with favoritism, you remember, and here it is again. Jacob's favorite wife, Rachel, had died giving birth to Benjamin. Jacob had lost his first favorite, Joseph. He doesn't know where in the world he is, or even if he is still alive. And all he has left of this true love and true family is this young man, Benjamin. So he's quite jealous and protective about his youngest, probably here, we don't know, but probably here, a boy or a teenager at this point. Verse 5 says that many people were journeying, making that journey from Canaan down to Egypt because there was no food anywhere. There wasn't any food in Canaan and there wasn't any food in Egypt. And the only place grain had been stored and was being made available was Egypt. So lots of people were making that journey that the sons of Jacob made. It took at least many days, possibly weeks of travel. And the brothers arrived probably to find long lines of starving people, just like they were. Maybe as far as the eye could see, you know, snaking around back and forth. But everyone that was there in line processed through one building where the Egyptian prime minister, Zaphnath-Paneah, personally approved all food that was purchased and distributed. So when it was finally their turn, the brothers all walk forward and bow their faces to the ground before Zaphnath-Paneah, resolved to appease or to bribe or to flatter or to grovel or to do whatever necessary to buy food and keep from starving. And in that moment, they had no idea that this man, Zaphnath-Paneah, who's enthroned before them, probably on an elevated platform, maybe up under some cover so that maybe it was shady, sitting on a throne, you know, maybe he had those servants next to him, fanning him with those big palm branches. That man was their brother, Joseph. They did not recognize him, but immediately he recognized them. And in that instant, with the 10 of them bowed down, licking the dust before him, he had a flashback to a dream God had sent him more than 20 years earlier. And he saw again stacks of grain, bundles of grain lined up and bowing before him exactly as these 10 brothers were now. But he kept his best poker face on and he didn't reveal any of this. And instead he addressed them, it says, very sternly, very roughly. He was careful to speak the language of the Egyptians through an interpreter to them. He did not greet them. He didn't bother with any diplomacy or pleasantries. Instead, he barked, "Where are you foreigners from?" Their clothes, their speech, their demeanor, and their physical appearance made it apparent they were Semitic, not Egyptian. And so he knew they were foreigners. Everybody knew they were foreigners. But his gruff tone caught them off guard. They replied, We are from the land of Canaan. We've traveled here to buy food. Again, through his interpreter, Joseph thundered, "You're lying. your spies. You're here to see our land in its time of nakedness. Security, come get these men. You can imagine the expression on their faces as they listen to the interpreter tell them what Joseph was actually saying to them. No, my lord, they begged. We're your servants. We're just here to buy bread. Again, Joseph thundered through his interpreter. I don't believe you. You are a band of 10 spies trying to infiltrate and exploit the secret places of our land while we're naked and exposed and vulnerable. What's Joseph doing here? Many have noted his tactic. He's being very shrewd. Joseph is like any good interrogator. Joseph is immediately putting his brothers on the defensive, and he's getting them to talk and to divulge details and information that he wants to know. They reply, no, my lord, we're just here to buy food. And we are honest men. We're not spies. We are at your service. We are actually 12 brothers. One, the youngest, is at home with our father, and the other one is, well, he's no more. Joseph, known to them as Zaphnath-Paneah, is unmoved. I don't believe you, but I will test you. By the life of Pharaoh, not one of you will return home until the supposedly younger brother travels down here to corroborate your story. Otherwise, you are spies, like I say. And then he threw them all into prison. And at this point, Joseph has arrived at the moment of decision. What will he do? What kind of story is this going to be? How is this going to turn out? If verse 17 were just a little different, imagine how the entire course of history would be changed. If verse 17 said, and he threw them all into prison, and then he went down and he revealed himself to his brothers and said, I am who the Egyptians call Zaphnath-Paneah, but formerly I was called Joseph. That's right. I'm the brother you all tried to murder and betrayed. What goes around comes around, boys. Tough luck. See ya. The end. Imagine what a different story this would be. What a different person Joseph would be. If the story ended this way, Genesis would only be 42 chapters long instead of 50. It would go from being one of the greatest stories in all the Bible that point us to foreshadow and type Christ. And it would become nothing more than an odd tale about personal revenge. Scripture tells us that revenge is a holy thing, meaning revenge belongs to God. It's holy in that way. It's a possession of God and not man. So we're not to grasp after it or take it for ourselves. Joseph, from this moment forward, he seems to understand this biblical truth. At the end of Genesis, thanks be to God, Genesis is actually 50 chapters and not just 42. And way at the end, when his brothers ask him directly why he didn't take revenge, he says, am I in the place of God? In other words, revenge belongs to God, not me. Vengeance belongs to God. He will repay. In Romans 12, the apostle reminded us of this, and he quoted Jesus' command. Jesus said, my disciples are to love their enemies and do good to them. And as I said, this reminder comes by way of Romans 12. You might remember Romans 12 begins with the famous lines, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed. How? By the renewing of your mind, that you may prove or show what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. There may be no greater area needing to be renewed in our minds, or by which we need to be transformed, than in this area of our testimony, to do the good and acceptable and perfect will of God by not acting vengefully. Instead, doing what Jesus calls us to do, doing good to our enemies and praying for them. We'll look at this command in a moment more fully at the table, but first, please pray with me. Our gracious and heavenly Father, it is your providence that governs all the affairs of human life, down to the most